There have been a lot of television series and movies over the years about the life of Jesus. One of the more recent ones is The Chosen. And I think the perspective it gives, not only of Jesus, but of the many other people who played part in the story of his life, can be really helpful. They also were real people with lives and stories of their own. People whose lives were often changed when their story intersected with Jesus' story. Well, in this episode of the Discover the Word podcast, we're going to focus on one of the people the scripture tells us was involved in the events leading up to Jesus' crucifixion. His name is Simon of Cyrene. And I think it's going to be a fascinating hour putting together the story of when Simon's life story intersected the Jesus story. Pull a chair up and we'll get started on some important conversations for Easter on Discover the Word next. Hi, I'm Brian Hettinga, and welcome to Discover the Word, a Bible engagement effort of Our Daily Bread Ministries. And you know, I look forward to these conversations that we have each year surrounding Easter. And this year, we're going to go back into our archive for a study that I found really memorable that explored the role of someone who was mentioned in three of the four gospel accounts of the life of Jesus, Simon of Cyrene. Around the table with you are Mark DeHaan, Elisa Morgan, and Bill Crowder. And Bill will be leading this study, gaining perspective from the point of view of Simon of Cyrene. He's the man who was ordered to carry Jesus' cross when our Lord could carry it no longer. Some really fascinating discoveries are ahead of us as we get familiar with some of the details of this part of the story of Jesus' crucifixion and death and resurrection. So glad you're here to discover the word with us. And let's jump right into this. As we join them, Mart, Annalisa, and Bill are talking about another film about the life of Jesus, The Passion of the Christ. Have you seen that one? Well, let's listen as they begin this study called Whose Cross Is It? By talking about the perspective that that film offers among the many perspectives that can help us understand better what was happening in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago.
When Mel Gibson released the film The Passion of the Christ, to say the least, it was very graphic, intentionally graphic. Some said gratuitously graphic, but if you've studied crucifixion, if you've studied it, you know that if anything, it undersold the kind of torture that was involved in crucifixion. But one of the things that compelled me about it was this was Mel Gibson's perspective. He was telling us the story as he envisioned it happening. This was his view of the sufferings of Jesus, and he got to do it through the lens of a camera.
Why do you say it was his view when they really did try to follow the text of Scripture?
Well, they tried to follow the text of Scripture, but they also used ancient documents. They also used histories. They also used other writers to help fill in some of the blanks, because one of the things that's made much of in the film are the times that Jesus stumbles under the weight of the cross. Never in the Gospels is he described as stumbling under the weight of the cross. And yet it seems to be a very strategic part of the story. And so what he did was, yes, he took the text of Scripture, he brought in some history and some other perspectives, and he really gives us his singular view, I think, of the cross. And that's a view that may or may not be accurate, because it's 2,000 years after the fact. But what I think might be good for us to do as we are moving toward Good Friday, moving toward Resurrection Day, as we're moving in that direction on our calendar, maybe it'd be better to see some of these events at least through the perspective of somebody who is actually there.
Okay.
And it's somebody whose name many of us as followers of Christ would readily say, oh, I know who that was. But we really don't think about him much. He's kind of like a piece of the staging. He's part of the set decoration. He's Simon of Cyrene. And we all know that he did what?
He carried the cross of Jesus.
He carried the cross of Jesus. And in that simple phrase, there's an awful lot of stuff going on that as we prepare to remember the cross and celebrate the resurrection can be very helpful to us in aiding our perspective by seeing his perspective.
And you were very strong on saying the Gospels nowhere talk about Jesus stumbling on the end of the cross.
Where do we get that,
then? Yeah, well, we'll find out. Okay. That's one of the things that we want to try to discover together this week, because I think there are these pieces to the story that require answers. And so let's get into it. as we do, we'll just start off by setting up the event, and it's going to take us a little while to do this because there's a lot going on that we just need to have as part of our perspective. But John 19, verses 16 through 17. Mark, would you read that for us?
Then Pilate turned Jesus over to them to be crucified, and so they took Jesus away. Carrying the cross by himself, he went to the place called the Place of the Skull, which in Hebrew is Golgotha.
You just went from Pilate's court to Golgotha without even a breath in between. But the other Gospels tell us there was a lot of stuff that happened in between. There were a lot of things that transpired on the road between Pilate's court and the place of execution. And that's where Simon of Cyrene is going to enter the story. But as we know, there are a lot of things that have transpired leading up to this particular moment when Pilate hands him over to be crucified. The night before started in an upper room. And what happened there?
They had their supper together, and Jesus really prophesied his death and resurrection. Mm-hmm. And he prayed for them, and he prayed for us.
Yeah.
And he also emphasized over and over again how important it was going to be for them to love one another as he was loving them. Mm-hmm. And he showed that by washing their feet, gave them an example.
He acted it out.
It was a very powerful moment in that upper room as he takes the place of the slave and washing the feet, as you said, Mart, as he takes elements from the Jewish Passover feast to create his own memorial table. Then they go to Gethsemane. And in Gethsemane, the agony really begins.
Yeah, while the disciples fall asleep.
Yeah. And then, of course, Judas and Malchus and this cohort of troops come to make the arrest. And that begins the series of trials and beatings and all of these things that have led up to this moment. Now, at this moment, when Pilate hands Jesus over to them to be crucified, is about 8:30 in the morning by our
reckoning. So he's been up all night.
He's been up all night. It's been about 2.5 hours since Jesus was brought to Pilate. And in that period of time, he's been tried before Pilate. He's tried before Herod. He's tried again before Pilate. And in the midst of that—
And not all in the same location.
Not all in the same location. He's been beaten multiple times. So that's just the last 2.5 hours. It's actually been maybe 14.5 hours since they started that Passover feast. So by this point, he's had basically 5 trials, at least 4 major beatings, and all of this over the span of the last 14.5 hours. That's unthinkable, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the beatings are not just being whacked with a hand. These are torturous, barbaric beatings.
Yeah, the cat of nine tails that the Romans used would inflict the maximum amount of torment on a person, but yet not give them the relief of death or even the relief of unconsciousness.
Mm-hmm.
This is extraordinary pain. And in a sense, this is, I think, part of what Isaiah was prophesying in Isaiah 53 as he talked about the cross and the events that led up to it. Elisa, if you would read verses 3 and 4 of Isaiah 53.
Verse 3, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted.
Then the next verse begins in verse 5. He was pierced for our transgressions. And that seems to picture the nails of crucifixion. So these are the elements of the story of Jesus that we don't like to think about. We don't like to think about exactly what our rescue cost.
The way that Isaiah threads and connects to John is amazing. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, and yet it was his body, and it was his cross. We're foreshadowed and we're backshadowed in everything he did.
It was our need that produced his pain. And you see that in all those beatings. You see that in all those events leading up to, even before the horrors of crucifixion. And I don't know about you, but it's hard for me to read that stuff and realize that he did all that just for me, that he went through all of that for me. I mean, what does that say about his love?
Yeah, your comment about the Isaiah passage is one I can really identify with, because even though I was watching it on film, this portrayal, I couldn't look at it. I found myself, as Jesus was beaten and whipped, as his flesh was slashed again and again. And it seemed like it just went on and on. I couldn't look at it. Mm-hmm. So when you read that from Isaiah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I think that as we see all of this leading up to this moment, Pilate delivers him over. They drop the cross on his shoulders. And we'll talk more about that as we get later into the week. But between that moment and the crucifixion moment, there is a road. And there are different kinds of people on that road. And there are different kinds of people watching this event from different perspectives. I would like to suggest to you that there are people who are viewing this horrified. How could somebody do this to another human being? I think there's some who are looking at it and they're indifferent. Who cares? I don't know him. He's not my family. Mm-hmm. I think there's some who are watching it who are almost like voyeurs. For them, this is entertainment. This is a spectacle. Mm. And as horrible as it sounds, there were probably some people who watched that film that way. Wow, look at that. And I think, how? But there's that piece of the brokenness of humanity. And then there were others who were watching from the crowd who were the faithful, who were not just horrified because he was a man, but they were grieved because they knew who he was and they knew that they had trusted him and they see this. And I think as we walk on the road with them this week, as we move through the story and we move along this road from Pilate's court to the place of execution, we'll find ourselves in some of these different people on the road. And it won't always make us comfortable. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it may even make us ashamed at how indifferent or how spectacular our view can be.
And so just as we started out today talking about how Mel Gibson may have seen this journey of Jesus, we each need to look with our own eyes and follow his journey. And I think you're saying that we're going to look at the specific view of Simon Cyrene as we consider how we too view Jesus.
As we go through this week, we're going to see these events through the eyes of a man. His unique perspective that I believe we will see changed his life. And along the way, we'll see a lot of details to the story that otherwise we wouldn't have hold of. As we see his story collide with Jesus' story, we'll get some answers to some of those questions.
Special study for Easter on this edition of the Discover the Word podcast called Whose Cross Is It? Hopefully seeing some fresh things in the events of Passion Week through the eyes of Simon of Cyrene, the man conscripted to carry Jesus' cross to Calvary when Jesus no longer could. And in this next part of the conversation, we're going to talk about Jesus' journey down the Via Dolorosa, the way of suffering, the road or street in Jerusalem that went from the court where he was condemned, to the hill where he was crucified.
Down the Via Dolorosa, the way to Calvary.
Yeah, and it is on the Via Dolorosa that Simon of Cyrene enters the story. So let's join Bill and Elisa and Mart as they talk about what it's like to visit that part of Jerusalem, as well as the lands of the Bible as a whole.
Mart, I know you've been in the Bible lands a number of times, and Elisa, I know Evan has been there, but you've not yet had the opportunity to go. The first time I went, I spent almost the whole time just with my mouth hanging open.
I bet.
It's just like you're drinking from a fire hose because you're trying to absorb so much, and it's so overwhelming. I mean, it really does just collapse your brain. Mm.
I understand what you're saying, because even when we were traveling from place to place in the bus, I never wanted to close my eyes. Mm-hmm. It just was so real, and I was so absorbed with the fact that this is the landscape, this is the backdrop, this is the region where God visited us.
Yeah. And you think about it, you know, there are a lot of places where they say, well, tradition says this might have happened here. You get all that kind of stuff, but then you also get the time when you're on the shore of Galilee, and you know, Jesus was here.
Yeah.
And that first time that I was in Israel, and the second time and the third time as well, I mean, it never got old. It was just like that every single time. It's just more than I could take in, except the exception to all of that was the day in Jerusalem when we walked the Via Dolorosa.
Which means what?
It means the way of suffering. And the Via Dolorosa is the Latin term to describe the path Jesus walked from Pilate's court to Golgotha, or Skull Hill, where he was crucified.
And you're saying you did not find that interesting?
It's not that I didn't find it interesting. I found it deflating. And the first thing that made it deflating for me was when our guide said, now the real Via Dolorosa is 25 feet underground because it's been buried over centuries and centuries and centuries. So what you're walking on isn't really the Via Dolorosa, but it's the Via Dolorosa. Yeah. Well, that immediately let some of the air out of my balloon. Mm-hmm. But you've been on there. What do you see when you're on there?
You see merchants, all kinds of shops. There's crowds usually. Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the crowds, and I don't know about the times you've been there, Mark, a lot of the crowds that I saw there were pilgrims, like our little group. And there were people, and sometimes they would be carrying crosses ahead of the group, and they would be kind of hushed and reverent. And there are different stations of the cross on the Via Dolorosa traditionally. And you'd see them stop at one of these, and maybe they'd softly read scripture and pray.
Are they reenacting Jesus' journey?
Sort of.
They're really just remembering, though, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, it's and mostly
remembering.
That.
And I'll bet if we asked a lot of them, too, they'd say, I don't care if it's 25 feet down.
Yeah.
You know, this is the city.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
They probably had a better attitude than I did. The thing with the Via Dolorosa that really got to me, though, wasn't just the fact that it was 25 feet underground. It was too worshipful. It was too reverent. It was too tranquil.
And you pictured it
And the way
messier.
It had to have been the morning Jesus walked, it would have been so much different from that. It would have been hostile. It would have been angry. And I think what really bothered me was that as I walked it, it was this very calming experience. And I know that it had to have been just the opposite 2,000 years ago when Jesus walked. Does that make sense?
Isn't it kind of like when we celebrate Christmas, though, and we see Jesus in this beautiful nativity scene? You know, we have dressed it up into something. We've prettified Jesus.
Okay.
And when you go back and you're trying to really remember what he went through, and you see stalls and merchants in a prettified scene on a road that was suffering, maybe that's a...
That's a great example of what Bill is saying.
And it wasn't that I expected the emotion to be there. It's just that it felt emotionally wrong the way I was experiencing. Maybe that's a better way to put it.
But you knew enough to know that it was different
that's
than this,
right? So in my mind, I knew how it played out. And I think that's what we want to see today. This week, we're going to walk the Via Dolorosa with Jesus, and we're going to do it through a man named Simon of Cyrene. And he's going to be our main character when we get to him more tomorrow. But yesterday we talked about the fact that in John's telling of this, there's a gap. In the space of two verses, you go from Pilate's court to Skull Hill. And we don't hear all the story that takes place in between. Well, we want to pick up the story in between. And part of it is really understanding what the mood would have been that morning on that street as Jesus got ready to walk it. So yesterday we read John 19, 16, and 17. Mart, if you still have that, could you read that again?
Okay. It's talking about Pilate. Then Pilate turned Jesus over to them to be crucified. And so they took Jesus away. Carrying the cross by himself, he went to a place called Place of the Skull, or in Hebrew, Golgotha.
Now what's interesting is, again, there's so much procedurally, remember, this was a legal transaction that had taken place. There had been a legal court that had rendered a verdict and a judgment attached to that verdict. And there are, just as in our courts, there are legal procedures that had to be followed. Mm-hmm. So when it says, so Pilate handed Jesus over to them to be crucified, there were actually legal procedures that he had to follow according to Roman law. The first thing he would have said following the declaration of crucifixion, he would have said, illum duci ad crucem placet, which in Latin means this man should be taken to a cross. Then he would have turned probably to the centurion who was in charge of the execution squad and would end up later being the centurion at the foot of the cross. And he would have said to him, emiles expedi crucem, go soldier and prepare the cross. At that point, Pilate's legal work is done. He's rendered the verdict, he has announced the judgment, and he has handed the prisoner over for execution. The next thing that would have happened would have been the centurion would have overseen the preparation of the cross.
And what's that? I mean, what do they do to prepare the cross?
Well, you know, it depends on the history that you read. And this is something, Mark, you and I have talked about a lot over the years. It seems like there were at least three different kinds of crosses. There was the St. Andrew's cross, which is an X-shaped cross. The St. Andrew's cross is so named because, according to tradition, Andrew, the brother of Peter, was executed on an X-shaped cross. The second kind of cross is the crux commisa, which is another Latin term, but it's really the cross shaped like a capital T. And oftentimes in Renaissance painting, you'll see the two thieves executed on those kind of crosses, but Jesus on what is called the Latin cross, which is like a lowercase T. And that's the one that we traditionally see.
Did each of these crosses have a different significance in terms of the crime that the,
not necessarily,
the person had committed? No.
A lot of it had to do with what was available. Okay. And what we know about Israel is there's not much wood available in Israel. It's pretty barren. That's why if it was the traditional cross, and it probably was, a lot of the art and film of Jesus carrying the entire cross probably isn't accurate. He was probably just carrying the cross piece itself.
The horizontal one.
The horizontal member, what in Latin was called the patibulum. That was probably what he carried, but that in itself would have probably weighed 30 to 40 pounds. Now, remember, we talked yesterday about everything Jesus has been through in the previous 14 and a half hours. Now he's got to carry this 30 plus pound load on shoulders that have been shredded by a whip with all of the pain and agony that goes with that. This is what it looks like as Jesus gets to set out on the Via Dolorosa. The way that it was done was that you had a condemned person, and for each condemned person, you would have a quaternion of four soldiers surrounding them. So in this case, you have Jesus and two thieves. So you have 12 soldiers in three quaternions, four for each one of them. They're the actual execution squad. Then out front, you have the centurion who's in charge of the execution detail. And then they would have anywhere from 100 to 120 other soldiers just for crowd control.
There's a lot of people.
There's a lot of people involved in this thing. Plus, you add to this the fact that it's 8:30 in the morning on the day of preparation for Passover. Mm. You have all of these pilgrims descending on the city for Passover, so you couldn't pick a worse time for a processional through the city. And yet this is the group that sets out through this kind of crowd. For today, as we get ready to meet Simon of Cyrene tomorrow, there's one piece of this that I would like for us to kind of land on before we leave our conversation. John 10, verses 17 and 18, tells us about the heart of Christ underneath all of the horror that he's enduring. Elisa, would you read that for me?
For this reason, the Father loves me, because I lay down my life so that I may take it again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative.
Now think about this. We look at the suffering of Jesus, the pain, the atrocities that were committed against him. I do this of my own initiative, he said. I embrace it. I take it willingly. I lay down my life voluntarily. And when you see exactly what that meant, it's pretty stunning to think that he willingly endures all of this for us. And I think as we move into the scene and see it through Simon's eyes, I think Simon is going to personally have the opportunity to experience the love that caused the Son of God to willingly take all this for us.
And all of this begins to happen on that journey between the court where Jesus was condemned and the hill on which he was crucified on the Via Dolorosa. That's where Simon of Cyrene, this Jewish man and his family, on a holiday pilgrimage to Jerusalem from their home in northern Africa, that's where Simon enters the story and is conscripted to carry Jesus' cross down the Via Dolorosa. And so next, we're going to get to know this man, Simon of Cyrene, learn more about where he was from and how his big holiday trip to Jerusalem was hijacked by an event that I'm sure he and his family would never forget. We'll pick this up after we take a short break. Now, of course, Simon is just one of the many people we read about in the Gospels who are part of what happened during Passion Week. And looking at how they experienced these life-changing events over 2,000 years ago is exactly what Bill Crowder does in a book he wrote called Windows on Easter, Men and Women Who Encountered Jesus. And next time you're online, I would invite you to head over to discovertheword.org and click on the Store tab up at the top of our homepage. In our store, look for that book, Windows on Easter by Bill Crowder. Each chapter is a lot like our study this week in that Bill dives deeper into the lives and roles of those along the path of Christ's walk to the cross and ultimately his victory over death. Again, click on Store on our discovertheword.org website and look for Bill's book, Windows on Easter. And now back to our Easter study called Whose Cross Is It?
Okay, I know that I can't be the only one who's endured a holiday where we've spent weeks and weeks preparing for it, and then at the last minute, something interrupts it in a really bad way. Anybody else ever been there?
Lisa, you're shaking your head.
Oh, mercy. Like, every time. It's like, you know, we expect the Thanksgiving turkey to come out of the oven perfectly and everybody gather around with applause, and instead the baby's screaming and your teenager's apathetically rolling his eyes and, you know, no.
You know, it's true, and I've had the same thing. I mean, our family has had the same kinds of interruptions or disruptions. But the amazing thing, you usually pull together and work it out, mm-hmm. don't you?
Usually.
Yeah, usually.
Not always.
Not always. Sometimes people just don't even show up at the table. But, I mean, that's happened.
Well, and you think of other folks maybe who have had the kind of disruptions impact their holidays, that their holidays are never the same again.
Yeah, well, that's serious. True.
There's a person in one of the churches that I pastored where the dad died on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
Well, Christmas was never going to be the same again for the rest of their lives because all of the joy and stuff that everybody else is sharing is marked by some real, real pain.
You're right. So if we're talking about tragic events,
yeah.
then you're happen. Right. Then you don't just get along with it.
No.
But there's a sense in which you do, because it's the holidays and there's certain things that are expected. So you put in another turkey, you wrap another present, you do all those things because you've got to get through again. And people in a grieving process have almost always historically said that it's the first time through the holiday cycle.
Without the loved one.
Without the loved one, that's the hardest time. Mm-hmm. And that's really true to life. When we start out with something that's supposed to be a celebration, and all of a sudden it ends up being something very, very different, it can be unsettling, can't it? We're slowly working our way to someone this week who, he's in preparation for a holiday, and all that that means in his culture. And in the middle of that preparation, there's an intrusion that really takes him off into a very, very different life path. And of course, we're talking about Simon of Cyrene, who famously was the man who carried Jesus's cross. And to understand all of this that we're talking about right now, it's helpful for us to understand what holiday was going on at the time Jesus was crucified.
Yeah, Passover.
Passover. What's significant about Passover in the minds of a Jew?
Well, it reminds them of the Exodus, and it reminds them of God bringing his people out of slavery in Egypt into their land, and how God passed over the Israelite homes and preserved them while he was striking down the Egyptians.
So it's a time of grateful remembrance.
Of God's provision and rescue.
That they never want to forget as a nation.
Right.
Yeah. And the key element of that Passover celebration was a lamb. The Passover lamb. At the time of the Exodus, take a lamb, sacrifice it, blood on the doorposts and lintel, the Passover will happen. And from that time on, they would begin a Jewish Passover feast, as they still do today, by the young child coming to the father and saying, why do we do this? Why do we do this? And the story is told of God's rescue once again. It's a powerful thing. Passover also is one of three high feasts in Israel where Jewish people make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem to celebrate the feast. And in the first century, that was very much the case. And that's what brings Simon of Cyrene to Jerusalem. If you'd remind us again where we've been the first few days, Mart, with John 19, verses 16 and 17, that'll get us going again.
Okay, we've been talking about what happened in between the events that John is describing here, right?
We're Correct.
Saying this is just framing it.
That's right.
It's not giving us any of the details.
Right.
So the framing that John gives us is, then Pilate turned Jesus over to them to be crucified, and they took Jesus away, carrying the cross by himself. He went to the place called Place of the Skull, or in Hebrew, Golgotha.
So as we've seen a couple of times, there's this big jump in John's story. He doesn't feel the need to tell us what the other three Gospels tell us, which that there's some stuff that happens between point A and point B between Pilate's court and Golgotha.
Bill, just quickly, if somebody says, well, why didn't John feel the need to do what the others are doing?
Well, it's interesting when you compare John's gospel with the synoptic gospels, and Matthew, Mark, and Luke are referred to as synoptics. It means with a single eye or a common view. They tend to tell the story very similarly, although each one has its unique characteristics. John tells it very differently. And some of that may go down to the fact that he wrote his gospel account maybe 50 years after theirs. Mm. And their stories were so well known, he's just filling in some gaps. I heard one scholar say that John's gospel is 92% unique.
Wow.
Compared to the other three gospels. Now, you gave us kind of the 30,000-foot view of he was here, now he's here. But in between, some other things happen. Elisa, Luke 23 gives us that. And if you'd give us verses 26 and 27.
As they led him away, meaning the soldiers, mm-hmm. they seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, and they put a cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. A large number of people followed, including women who mourned and wailed for him.
There are a couple of things there. First of all, it gives us a little view into the crowd. Some scholars estimate that in the first century, that the city of Jerusalem, which would normally have maybe 500,000 people, would swell to 2.5 million people.
It's huge.
Because of people coming in mm-hmm. for this.
Okay.
And they come for the Passover lamb to be sacrificed at the temple.
Yeah, all of that is temple-centered,
yeah,
really, isn't
it? Yeah, it's all temple-centered. And also, it has to be done according to certain ceremonial restrictions and guidelines. And so you have all these things. Also, you have the fact that Jerusalem's really a kind of a small city by modern terms, and people of that number descending on the city would have quickly spilled over. And so people who are late arriving, they're not going to be able to find a place in the city, so they're going to camp out in the country. Simon, it says, was coming in from the country. Mm-hmm. So apparently he's one who has made this pilgrimage and he's gotten there late. It says that he is from Cyrene. Anybody want to take a stab at where Cyrene is? Cyrene is North Africa. It's actually in modern day Libya, near the Mediterranean coast, near the modern day city of Tripoli. So he had quite a journey mm-hmm. to get there. Mm-hmm. Simon, of course, is a Hebrew name. So you can assume that he's Jewish. He's on this pilgrimage for Passover. He's made this huge journey. He gets there. Now, in order to get ready to celebrate the feast, he has to come into Jerusalem and get all of the kosher provisions so that they can prepare for the Passover feast that night. And that's what brings him into town and brings him onto this scene.
Now, I picture him kind of on a mission.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got his grocery list mm-hmm. that has been put together. Part of that grocery list is a lamb that has to be offered, that has to be sacrificed. But there are a bunch of other elements of this feast. There are bitter herbs, there's a paste called keresheth, there's unleavened bread. There are a whole lot of different pieces to the feast. And as Simon of Cyrene comes into town, your term, Elisa, he's on a mission. He's got to get all this stuff so he can get back, because this is the day that is referred to in Jewish culture as the day of preparation. It is the day in which they have to prepare for the holiday that they're going to celebrate.
And suddenly he's seized.
Yeah.
That word is so dramatic. And you're painting this picture of this tumult. And I'm starting to picture in modern day times, this is as if you're in your car and you're heading to the grocery store and all the streets are busy. There's a traffic jam. And suddenly someone commandeers your car
yeah.
and shows a badge and takes yeah. you off and you're out of control. And that's what Simon was going through. He's so interrupted.
Yeah. It's an interruption in his holiday,
mm-hmm.
in a sense. He's come to celebrate, and he's going to find himself drawn into a vortex of something very, very different than the celebration he had anticipated. Now, I think that as we see all of this happening, the focus, from our perspective, may also be what was one of the main focal points of his perspective, and that was the lamb. You had to get to the temple early because you had to secure a lamb and you had to have it prepared and you had to have it offered. Then you had to get it back. He is all about the lamb and he has no idea how much he's going to be about the lamb before this day finally ends. All he knows is he's come to this city to celebrate. He's come to this city to remember an ancient rescue, not knowing that he's going to become part of the story of God's eternal rescue. He's come to buy a lamb. He is going to come to the aid of the lamb. When you were a kid, did you like to volunteer for things or did you have to be volunteered?
Depended on if I felt like I could do it well. If I could do it well, I'd like to show off.
Yeah,
if I didn't, I would cower.
I'm sure that, you know, sixth, seventh, middle school and high school, man, let somebody else do it.
No one volunteers in middle school for anything.
Okay.
Yeah. It's interesting, the idea of volunteering for things. When I was a pastor, I had a book called The Art of Recruiting Volunteers. And that seemed like a little bit of a contradiction in terms. Mm-hmm. Either they volunteer or you recruit them, but you don't recruit volunteers. and yet, you know, sometimes you recruit volunteers, yeah. I guess. So, but volunteerism is an interesting thing because done rightly, volunteerism is where we really do something as an expression of our heart because we believe in it. We're all in, we're sold. But if you have to be recruited to volunteer, you wonder if the same level of commitment is behind it. I'm thinking about volunteers and volunteering because we've been talking this week about Simon of Cyrene, and he did not volunteer, nor was he recruited to volunteer. Actually, some much more harsh words were used to describe his being pulled into the story of Jesus' journey from Pilate's court to Golgotha. And we've got a couple of texts that describe it. I'd like for us to think about it today and think about it in terms of what it was and how it might have felt, and how it feels to us. Those are things that may not make sense right now, but hang with me and maybe we'll get there. So, Elisa, would you give us the text out of Luke 23:26?
Okay, when they, meaning the soldiers, led him, meaning Jesus, away. So when they led him away, they seized a man, Simon of Cyrene, coming in from the country and placed on him the cross to carry behind Jesus.
Now, Mart, if you would give us the way it reads in Matthew's Gospel, Matthew 27:32.
It says, along the way, they came across a man named Simon, who was from Cyrene, and the soldiers forced him to carry Jesus' cross.
And in Mark 15:21, and they, the soldiers, pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. So we have seized from Elisa's text in Luke.
Forced
in Matthew, and then pressed into service in my translation of Mark. Now, those are all very strong words to describe.
They don't sound like he volunteered.
No, they don't sound like he volunteered, and they don't sound like he was recruited.
No.
Something else happened. And as we prepare to look at that, Elisa, can you just remind us where we've been so far this week to get us back into the story?
This is a dramatic week. It's actually just the day after the upper room time, the Last Supper, as we've come to call it, where Jesus prophesied his death and spoke to his disciples about what he needed, what they could expect, prayed for them for strength, and then he went to the Garden of Gethsemane.
There he struggled with his father in prayer, didn't he?
My cup, your cup, my will, your will, how to go about this. And now he's been up all night and he goes before various courts and then he's beaten and scourged and now a beam, probably you suggest the horizontal beam of the cross that he will be nailed to. He's carrying himself up the way of suffering towards the
hill. And you have to
assume
at that point that he didn't have much strength, right?
Right.
Not left after the lashing, the beating.
Yeah, this really plays in, Mark, to something that we hinted at earlier in the week and kind of set aside for a time. In film depictions of this event, in paintings, you always see Jesus stumbling under the weight of the cross. Now, what's very interesting is nowhere in the Gospels does it ever describe Jesus stumbling. So why is it that they always do in film and other things? Well, part of it is just reasonability. I mean, what you just said, just the total absence of strength to carry on one more step, let alone carry this wooden beam along the way. Another thing that contributes to it being presented is him stumbling under the cross. We talked about the Via Dolorosa, the way of suffering, and how the traditional Via Dolorosa has different stations of the cross where you remember different things that happened there. There are three different stations of the cross in the Via Dolorosa that remember times that Jesus supposedly stumbled. So there is a traditional background to that as well. But maybe the biggest reason to believe that Jesus stumbled under the cross is Simon of Cyrene. There's no reason for him to enter the story.
Why else would the soldiers have pulled him in?
That's right, because they, at this point, I don't think that we need to conjecture a whole lot to say these guys aren't really concerned about how Jesus feels.
No.
But if we use our imagination a little bit, it almost seems like it would be so easy to see that at this point, Jesus did stumble. He was lying on the ground. He couldn't get up under the weight of the cross. I mean, there almost has to be, he's at the end of himself.
Mm-hmm.
That image of Jesus, to me, that is the extreme expression of humanity. Mm-hmm. And he was so fully human. Mm-hmm. It just staggers me.
If you can, as you said, Mark, use biblical imagination and see Jesus yet again stumbling under the weight of the cross.
It makes me feel like he's stumbling under the weight of my cross,
it's
my
all of that.
Sin, who
absolutely.
I am.
And could go no further.
That's right. And at this point, to the Roman soldiers, this is a matter of expediency. We've got a job we've got to get finished.
Get this guy out.
Historians tell us there was a Roman practice called the tap of the spear. And what it taught was that in any Roman-occupied country, the lowest Roman soldier could conscript any citizen of that occupied country at any moment to force them to carry his gear for the space of 1 mile. And so what you can envision as Jesus is laying there under the weight of the cross is the centurion in charge of the crucifixion turns to one of the four soldiers responsible for Jesus and says, "Press someone into service." And he leans into the crowd and taps with the spear, and he gets Simon of Cyrene. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for our purposes, this idea of the tap of the spear is really, really important because he's a conscript. He's not a volunteer. He didn't sign up for this because he believes
in it. He's been drafted. That's what that word means.
That's right. And you think about it in the context of what the situation is. Imagine how horrible it would be to be pulled into the middle of this event.
Mm.
And to take this cross on your shoulders and to have to carry it, knowing that it's going to be the death instrument of this man that maybe you don't even know anything about because you're from out of town.
And would everybody who saw you a little further down the road and didn't see you tapped, would they think you were a criminal because you were carrying this beam as well?
I don't know, but there would certainly have been stigma attached to it. What we do know is this. This practice of the tap of the spear was viewed as absolute humiliation to occupied people. You could be the wealthiest man in town, and you had to carry somebody, this lowly legionnaire's baggage and stuff.
It's like being a slave.
It's exactly right. And yet, this thing, this tap of the spear thing that Simon just experienced, this is the very thing that Jesus lifted out of the culture and said, this is what a servant's heart looks like.
What do you mean?
In Matthew 5, verse 41. Elisa, do you have that?
I do. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles.
That's it. The forcing to go 1 mile, that's the tap of the spear.
Meant.
They could force you to carry it. And what you would do is you'd see them tap somebody, they'd carry it. And they'd count the steps in their head. And once they got to a mile, they dropped the stuff and left. And Jesus said, wait a minute. Take this thing and turn it into the picture of service. Turn it into a picture of a servant's heart, even to your oppressor, even to your occupier. And it gives this whole thing a different context. Because now the tap of the spear is something that's not a drudgery. It's something that gives you the opportunity to display a heart that reflects the heart of God.
But do we have any reason to believe that Simon came to it with that motive or that heart?
Oh, there's no way that he would have.
No.
But that's the lesson that Jesus used it to teach in his own teaching. Where I think it gets really interesting with Simon is if we take his experience of the tap of the spear and allow that to be the context as we listen to the words of Jesus in Matthew 16. Listen to these words in the context of Simon's experience. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Now, all of a sudden, we see this picture of Simon taking up this cross and following him. And I wonder about myself, how many times I resist it and push against it and say, no, not today, not today, not today. And yet God wants to say, no, today, today, follow me today. Take up your cross today.
Yeah, this- This is Discover the Word, and you're at the table with Mark DeHaan, Elisa Morgan, and Bill Crowder. And Bill is leading us in a study of Simon of Cyrene, really a minor character, but with an important role in the Easter story. Interesting to think about how even something like the tap of the spear could be something God uses for his purposes. It kind of causes us to step back and think about how God may be working in our lives too, doesn't it? Well, I think we're discovering that this is a good story within the bigger story, isn't it? But the end of this aspect of the story is kind of left unfinished. What happens to Simon after he carries Jesus' cross is left untold. And so what we're going to do in the last segment of this podcast is spend some time speculating about what may have happened to Simon, this unsuspecting participant in the Easter story. And there are some biblical clues that make us say, what if? Well, we'll explore that after a quick word about our next podcast. You know, sometimes we read about amazing things in the Bible and it doesn't register that that really was amazing.
The Christian community here in the West is so informationally oriented that we take those truly wonder-inspiring things and just turn them into data points instead of letting them fill our hearts with awe as to who Jesus really is. And not only what he did, but what he still does today.
Yeah, and so don't miss the next Discover the Word podcast as we look at five amazing moments in Luke. And like Bill said, be prepared to recognize the amazing things that God is doing in your life. Don't miss the next Discover the Word podcast, Amazing Moments in Luke. Let's listen as Bill and Elisa and Mart reflect on how this interruption of having to carry Jesus' cross very possibly changed Simon's life and his family's life. And so how do you normally do with interruptions? Are you annoyed by them, frustrated by them, angered by them? Whoa, speaking of interruptions, that's my phone. I'm going to get that real quick. And so you listen as Bill begins with a question about your phone and why he feels like his phone is one of life's great interrupters. Hello? Yeah, hi.
Do you like your phone?
What can I do for you?
I love my phone, and I don't think I'm alone. I think most of America reports that we have love addictions to our phone.
That is so sad.
I'm all in. I agree. But it's not just a phone anymore.
No.
That's the beauty of these things.
No, it's like, to me, it's an umbilical cord. It's a tether to the people that I love. It's the way we communicate.
I knew that both of you were just going to be madly in love with your phone, and I'm sitting over here, and I hate my phone. Not only
What's
do I hate my
you?
Phone, I hate all phones.
Oh, my word.
But the thing, why? You're a techie. I mean,
Yeah, but you know what? I think this is some of the residual scarring from my years as a pastor, because most of the time when you're a pastor and the phone rings, it's bad news.
That's true.
But, you know, to you, Elisa, your phone is a picture of love and connectivity and all that kind of stuff. Mark, to you, it's fun, but it's information and it's access. To me, it was just interruption. It was just interruption. No matter what I was doing in life, I knew the phone was going to ring and I was going to be interrupted. And so I have that kind of a negative connection to it, to my own problem. But yesterday, in our next to the last conversation about Simon of Cyrene, we saw him receive the ultimate interruption, didn't we? There was this thing called the tap of the spear. What was that about, Elisa?
That's when a Roman soldier could reach out his spear and tap anybody to carry his equipment or his armor, whatever, however long he wanted them to, but usually a mile, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, they could carry it. You were forced to carry it at least mile.
Okay.
This is by Roman law.
By Roman law. And Jesus, if you remember, took that and turned it into something else, didn't he, Mark?
Yeah, he turned it into, instead of simply an obligation, he turned it into an opportunity to serve and to show that this man has a different heart.
Yeah. Yeah. And he said, if someone compels you to go with them 1 mile, go with them two. Go with them 2 miles. Go the extra. Do the extra. Simon yesterday received the tap of the spear as he's coming in from the country, apparently to prepare for the Passover and to get ready for all of that. And out of this throng of people, Jesus apparently stumbles under the cross, maybe several times. And when he can't go any further, a soldier reaches into the crowd and interrupts Simon's life, interrupts his life.
Don't you wonder why Simon got it?
I do. Yeah, I wonder if he was taller or younger or stronger.
Or smaller.
Smaller.
Yeah. And you know, all of those things. To the Roman soldier, it was probably just whoever was close by. There was probably a certain sense of randomness to it even. But I wonder if in that apparent randomness, there's not God's design.
Well, there has to be. That
in what sense?
In the sense that God wanted Simon's day interrupted because he had something better for him than Passover. And that was exposure to Jesus. I think that Simon needed to see the real Passover.
But that could have been true of anybody in the crowd, couldn't it?
It could have been. But apparently, Simon was the one. Because it's interesting, all three of the Synoptic Gospels tell us of Simon's participation. All three of them name him.
They use his name. Uh-huh.
They use his name, which there are a lot of people in the Bible that are randomly, seemingly pulled into the story. We don't ever hear what their name is.
Right.
They use his name, which implies that he was known to the readers. Now, what's interesting, Mark 15, verse 21, tells us another piece of this. Elise, do you have that?
Verse 15, verse 21?
Yeah.
A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross.
The father of Alexander and Rufus. Now, the question is, who cares?
Right.
Who cares about Alexander
and
Rufus?
Alexander and
why
Rufus?
Do their names? Not only do we get Simon's name, now we're getting his kids' names.
Wow.
Now, why would we get that? Unless there's reason to believe that Simon became known and his family became known as followers of the Christ whose cross he carried. Let's take it one step further. Mark, would you turn to Romans chapter 16?
Okay. What verse?
Romans 16, verse 13.
Paul is writing, and at the end, he's mentioning a number of different friends that he wants greetings sent to. He says, "Greet Rufus," interesting, "whom the Lord picked out to be his very own, and also his dear mother, who has been a mother to me."
Now, what's interesting about this is that most scholars believe that the Gospel of Mark was written to Rome. And he's careful not only to include Simon's name, but also his two sons, mm-hmm. Rufus and Alexander. And then when Paul writes to that same audience, he highlights somebody in that fellowship who is a chosen man in the Lord. How did your translation put it again? I thought
again,
it was so good.
It was "Greet Rufus, mm-hmm. whom the Lord picked out to be his very own, and also his dear mother, who has been a mother to me."
In Paul's writing, is Rufus a common name?
Rufus was not an uncommon name. But again, why would Mark mention those names unless there was a reason to mention them? So as Simon takes that cross and the embarrassment of being pulled into this situation, and then he goes to Calvary.
You're saying he's under the load.
Under the load.
He carries that crossbeam proudly.
And he's in the center of this whirlwind of activity and mockery and all of this. And it's just this horrible, horrible scene that he has been drafted into. Mm. And now they get to Calvary. Let me just speculate.
Speculation is, how could he have become a possible follower of Christ, right?
That's right. What if when they get to the place of the skull, he doesn't drop the cross and run away as fast as he can? What if he stops and stays?
Oh, I can see this, Bill, because, you know, if he has been carrying this heavy beam, I think you said in another program, 30 to 40 pounds mm-hmm. or so heavy, and he's been following the Christ, he's been following Jesus who's been scourged and who's bleeding and who wears a crown of mm-hmm. thorns inexplicably to Simon.
Yeah.
If he follows him up the hill, wouldn't you really want to figure out who
something
this guy
about
is?
Him.
Yeah, yeah, what's going on here? Why is this happening?
Yeah, you wonder too whether or not it's possible that he might have heard rumors about mm-hmm. this Jesus once mm-hmm. he realized whose cross this was.
Mm-hmm.
That could have caused him
to stay
around.
And then staying, he's watching the jeering of others and the sign above.
Yeah, the sign over Jesus' head, "This is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Now, as apparently a Jewish man from North Africa who's come to worship in the courts of Judaism at the temple, seeing the King of the Jews would have a connection to that crown that Jesus was wearing. Can you imagine him standing here trying to make sense of all this? And then he hears Jesus say, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." And then he sees, as the crowd mocks the women, just brokenhearted over this, and Jesus dealing so tenderly with his mother in the midst of his own suffering. And then he turns to the thief on the other cross and says, "Today, you're going to be with me in paradise." After the thief talks about a kingdom to this man who is being declared a king. Mm-hmm. Don't you think that it's possible that after the events of this, Simon went home and had a lot of thinking to do? Mm-hmm. And maybe he went and sought out people. Maybe people he had seen there at the cross. Maybe those women.
And maybe Rufus and Alexander, who were with him, also had questions. And maybe they also observed. And maybe their Passover dinner was very different that year.
And every year to come. Because having come to celebrate the Passover, Simon became drawn into the events of God's true and better Passover, God's greater Passover, his Passover lamb who had come to take away the sins of the world. And now all of a sudden, Simon has a story to tell his sons who end up becoming part of the fabric of a congregation and whose wife, Simon's wife, is so invested in this that she becomes like a mother to the Apostle Paul. I mean, it's a phenomenal
story. Isn't it
beautiful
to see how personal the gospel can be? You know, here is Jesus on a road going to his death on a cross for you and me. And yet here are people that he interacts with, people that are tapped seemingly randomly on the shoulder to do a service, to carry a cross. But in the end, it is that activity that brings them intersecting into the life of Jesus. And God does that with every one of us. All the time, if we pay attention, you know, he is inviting us to experience his sacrifice on the cross for us every day.
Mm. I think that when you look at Simon of Cyrene and his family, what you're seeing is the work of the cross lived out in flesh. The work that Christ came to do was more than just to take us out of this life and to some kind of heavenly reward. It was to dramatically transform us here and now as well. And here's a man who's coming for one purpose and it gets transformed. Here's a man who's a bystander in the crowd and his day is transformed. Here's a man who goes back home and it seems as though his family is transformed. And that's the power of the cross. And that's why Jesus came.
And so with that, we come to the end of our study of Simon of Cyrene, who was pulled from his holiday celebration to carry the cross of Christ and was likely changed forever. You almost think, how could he not have been? Well, this is Discover the Word. Discover the Word is a small group Bible study from Our Daily Bread Ministries in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in which we invite you to walk with us through topics and passages that inform the way we read the Scriptures, challenge us as we live our lives as followers of Christ, and always point us to discover Jesus in the pages of the Bible. And I hope that after this episode that you won't ever look at Jesus' journey to the cross the same way. And can I recommend you do something? There's a powerful song called Watch the Lamb that tells this part of the Easter story. And I mean, it is really powerful. Look it up on YouTube and watch the video. Search Watch the Lamb and you'll be moved. I know you will. And this Discover the Word study will be reinforced in your mind. Again, the song and the video are called Watch the Lamb. And as we wrap this up, I would encourage you to think back to when you first encountered Jesus. Maybe it was when one of your friends invited you to your first Bible study, or someone gave you a devotional to read, or just in some way you were introduced to Jesus. Well, you can play an important role in inviting others to have an encounter with Jesus when you partner financially with us at Discover the Word and Our Daily Bread Ministries. Our mission is to make the life-changing story and wisdom of the Bible understandable and accessible to people all around the world. And so if you are interested in joining us in our mission, visit our website at discovertheword.org. Click the Donate button up at the top of the page at discovertheword.org. Well, thanks for listening. I'm Brian Hettinga. Have a great Easter. Discover the Word is provided by Our Daily Bread Ministries.